Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Out of respect to you, we have a radio-controlled clock and we'll start exactly on time, so that time is of ultimate importance to everybody, and we'll start on time and all being well, we'll finish on time too. I would like, on behalf of Mrs. Fielding, to welcome family, members of the Kehillah, the community, and friends outside the community here to the second memorial shir, memorial lecture, in memory of our beloved friend, member, Marcus Fielding, Moshe Ben David. It's particularly relevant as we deal with the Sedras Vayakhel Pekutei, which deal with the work of Moshe Rabbeinu, who put up the tabernacle, put up the Mishkan, and that was Moshe Rabbeinu's work. Here is Moshe, Marcus Fielding, his work. In his way, he did fantastic work. He worked in a way of being a loyal servant to the community. He did what he could and worked for others, and therefore it's very befitting that we should gather together and have this memorial shir. There are three reasons why this memorial shir is something which is particularly important. One reason is because, however unforgettable Marcus was and is to us all, but human nature is human nature, and we need to get together at least once a year to stop and remember and refresh in our minds this wonderful person, wonderful friend, wonderful family member that we had in our midst, so that we can keep this memory fresh in our minds. That's the purpose of a zikaron, a memorial, to keep that eternity, to keep that wonderful memory, exemplary memory, with us. The other reason is that when we get together, and we get together in the purpose of remembering Marcus, and we connect it with a shir, something of spiritual value, something of eternal worth, we connect Marcus with eternity, and Marcus, in his own way, remains eternal in his input, in his influence upon us in a most positive way. And the third reason for this gathering is that Mrs. Fielding is continuing Marcus's wonderful work in Eretz Yisrael, looking after deprived families, individuals, and the social work is something of a tremendous mitzvah. And after the shir, which is going to be given by Rabbi Chaim Rappaport, who is a close family friend, and after the shir, I would like for a few minutes, on behalf of Mrs. Fielding, to make an appeal that we should help in whatever way we can, in a financial way, I mean, in order to be able to continue the work that Mrs. Fielding is continuing on behalf of Marcus. And this in itself is also a sense of eternity, to continue that work even after the work that he would have so much loved to have continued and to have seen to its end. With no further ado, I have the great honour of calling Rabbi Chaim Rappaport to talk on the topic of Losach Moed, that one of the Ten Commandments, that one mustn't covet somebody else's property. The rest I leave to Rabbi Rappaport.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. May I be Rabbi Sai, Birshus Haram, or the Asra. It is a great honor for me to deliver here the second lecture, memorial lecture, in honor of Moshe Ben David, Marcus of Blessed Memory. I've chosen the subject for reasons which I will explain towards the end of my lecture, but I hope will become evident to you in the course of the lecture already. The Ten Commandments are divided into two. The first five are commandments between man and God. The second commandments are commandments between man and man. This division, at least insofar as the second five commandments are concerned, should be pretty obvious. Do not murder, do not commit adultery, do not steal or do not kidnap, as the case may be. Do not bear false, do not give false testimony, and do not covet, are all commandments that govern interpersonal relationships between man and man, between woman and woman, between human being and human being. Lo sachmoid is one of these commandments. But in contradistinction to all the first nine commandments, the commandment lo sachmoid arouses two very important and obvious questions. Firstly, if you look at most English translations of the Pentateuch, the commandment lo sachmoid is translated as thou shalt not covet, a commandment against desiring that which belongs to someone else. Covet means desire for that which belongs to someone else. And there is an obvious philosophical or theological question that we confront here. If we look at the commandments of the Torah in general, 613 of them, we will see that they may be divided into three categories. There are commandments addressed to thought, things which we're supposed to think about, or things which we're not supposed to think about. There are commandments which are addressed to speech, things which we're supposed to say, and others which we're not supposed to say. And there are commandments which are addressed to deeds, the deed that may be done, and the deed that may not be done. Hence, do not entertain thoughts of idolatry or heresy is a commandment about which thoughts we may provide hospitality for in our minds. Yes? Think about the greatness of God is, of course, again, directed to the mind. Say the Shema, say prayers, say blessings, that's speech. Do not speak Lashon Hara, do not speak slanderous talk, libel, that's again speech. Again, with deed, build a sukkah, affix a mezuzah, is the do's, and then you have the things that you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to steal, you're not supposed to, so on and so forth. Here we have a commandment that ostensibly, at least at face value, addresses not the realm of deed, thought, or speech, but the realm of emotion. Tells us, do not covet. It's a strange commandment. A commandment not to feel. A person sees that someone else has something that he wants. Yes? And every time he sees that person with a particular car or a particular model, or a particular wife or husband or whatever it may be, his heart or her heart skips a beat. And he becomes completely infatuated and desirous of that which the other person has. His heart and his soul are consumed with the desire, with the love, with the quest to obtain that which belongs to someone else. And here the Jews were standing at Mount Sinai and hearing the Ten Commandments, and God delivered them, and he said, Jews, thou shalt not covet. Do not desire that which you desire. Is it possible for a person to love that which he hates, or to hate that which he loves? Is it possible for a person to command his emotional faculties, how they should react? It would seem not. You can command the person what to do or what not to do, how to think or what not to think, because even thought is very difficult to govern. But we do have a degree of control as to which thoughts we allow to linger in our minds and which thoughts we drive out, we expel as soon as they enter our minds. But same with speech. We can close our mouths. It may be very hard to do so, but we can exercise discipline over what we say or what we don't say. When it comes to feelings, a person has a feeling, how can he stop feeling a certain way? Commandments do not usually govern feelings. And therefore, it would seem at face value that it is somewhat of an impossible commandment to fulfill. In Yiddish there's a saying, and I know some of you speak Yiddish, when you speak about Mesiras Nefesh, you think of a person jumping off the roof. So they say, mit Mesiras Nefesh kemen arop springen vom Dach. Or the springen vom der Erde auf dem Dach, wie viel Mesiras Nefesh man hat, kemen das nicht tun. Yes, Mesiras Nefesh, self-sacrifice, a person can jump off the roof onto the ground. But to jump from the ground onto the roof, however much Mesiras Nefesh, martyrdom, self-sacrifice, self-annihilation, abnegation, you name it, it's not going to help. It's simply impossible for a human being to jump from the ground level onto the roof. Right? So there are certain things which don't subject themselves to commandments. So how can we tell a person who does crave for that which belongs to someone else, lo yisachmet? This is an obvious question, which I'm sure the people may have thought of, but it seems so obvious and so pertinent because it relates to one of the commandments, which, as the Sefer HaChinuch and other codifiers tell us, is a commandment that applies to all. It applies in Israel and in the diaspora. It applies to men and to women. It applies to young and old. It applies in all situations, and it applies to so many things. Because different people have different cravings. Some people like money, other people like wealth, other people like other things. Whatever it is they want, they have a commandment, lo yisachmet. So what is the meaning of this commandment? So I'm going to split the shiur down the middle, and I'm going to explain that there are essentially two ways of understanding this commandment. The first completely circumvents this difficulty altogether. It makes it a non-starter. The second, of course, does not. But then, of course, we have to confront the question. So let's shelve this question, and we're going to now open Maimonides, the Rambam in his magnum opus, the Mishnah Torah, in his book of Nezikin, that's tort law, Nezikin, damage, and the laws of theft, Hilchos Gezeilah V'Aveidah Perek Aleph, where he discusses the laws of Leisachmoid, and the Rambam's phraseology is found also both in the Torah and in the Shulchan Aruch, the classical Jewish codes of law. According to Rambam, Torah, Shulchan Aruch, these great canons of Jewish law, Lo Yisachmoid does not mean do not covet. It means something else. What does it mean? The Rambam says as follows. If a person imposes pressure upon another human being, whether he drives him mad, or he gets friends to intercede on his behalf, until he parts company with that which belongs to him, then this is what the Torah means when it says Leisachmoid. So for example, I have my eyes set on a particular Volvo. It's a Jewish car, and it's just the right size for my family. The fact that I don't drive is just a secondary issue here. But a person has got his eyes fixated on a Volvo, right? And he sees his neighbor's got this Volvo. The other person doesn't need such a big car. His children are away, they're married, they're away from home, and it seems that it's just right for him. And it doesn't want to get a different Volvo, it's just this particular model, this particular car that belongs to someone else. He wants that car, none other. So he approaches his neighbor and he says, do you mind, would you consider, by the way, you know, what do you need such a big car for? You could have a smaller car, I would like to buy a Volvo. The other person says, no, I'm not interested in selling it, it's not up for sale, it has sentimental value, I got it as a birthday present for my 50th, and I'm not interested in selling the Volvo. So then, since they're neighbors, they see each other. And every so often, he asks him again, and again, and each time he says no. Then he imposes more pressure. So for example, the neighbor asks him for a favor, and at a moment of weakness, he says, yeah, I'll do it for you, but please do remember that I'm still interested in the Volvo. And he keeps up the pressure till there comes a point in time where the other person decides, and probably rightfully so, that his peace of mind is worth more than his Volvo. So he says, you know what, take it. The other person pays him in full, not a penny less than the market price, maybe even more. This person who has purchased, acquired the Volvo, has transgressed the biblical commandment of Lois Tachmas. The same is true if it's someone else's wife. So he has got a crush on another person's wife. Now, of course, here it's not so simple, because the other person can't sell his wife. So he's got a two-tiered system here. On the one hand, he has got to ingratiate himself with the wife, but he's also got to make sure that she becomes available for him. So he does both. Half the time he spends on being the sweetest gentleman under the sun to the wife, and whenever there's something broken or there is something needed, he makes sure to be around and to be available and to provide it. And he perhaps gets wind of the fact that the Shalom Bayis, the domestic harmony, is less than perfect in this home. So he really becomes the ideal gentleman. And then he employs various other tactics, perhaps even direct speech to the person involved. He gets involved in conversations, and he asks them how things are, and the other person confides in him, and he advises him one way or another to do things which are going to lead to a divorce. So the other man divorces his wife and he marries her. Now she's free. That person has transgressed the commandment of Lois Tachmas. Lois Tachmas. Rambam then goes on to say, but if you look at the second time in the Pentateuch, in the Chumash, where the Ten Commandments are recorded, and that's in Parshas Vayechanan, the Torah employs another term. In the book of Deuteronomy, rather than using the term Lois Tachmas, the root being Ches Mem Dalet Chomad, the Torah uses the word Lois Tisaveh. Tisaveh is generally translated as desire, tava. But the Rambam says that the word here has the connotation of something that takes place inside the person's heart, in his internal. That is the idea of Lois Tisaveh. It refers to something which goes on within, rather than something that a person does in relation to other people. Having said that, Lois Tachmas doesn't mean coveting in the conventional sense of the word, but means manipulation, twisting of arms. What does Lois Tisaveh mean? So the Rambam says, Lois Tisaveh means once the person has set his mind on obtaining the other person's Volvo or the other person's wife, and not only has set his mind upon it, he has already begun to work out in his mind how he will obtain it, a stratagem, a technique through which he will be able to manipulate the various pawns in the game in order to be able to get hold of that which he wants. He has thus violated Lois Tisaveh. Somewhat ironically, Lois Tisaveh is the second commandment. But to sum it up what I've said till now, in accordance with the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, the tenth commandment of the Decalogue of the Aseret HaDibros is essentially two commandments, two biblical commandments. One in verse Hanan, the other in Yisrael. The second, Lois Tisaveh, means do not fix your heart upon obtaining that which belongs to another human being. Do not contrive, do not plot, scheme, and strategize how to obtain it. Once a person does that, he has transgressed the commandment Lois Tisaveh. When the person goes further and he goes to the next stage and he actually translates this into action and he starts the manipulative process, then the person has also transgressed the commandment Lois Tachmas. But he has only been over on the law, transgressed the negative commandment, when the other person buckles under the pressure and actually gives the item to him. These are the two commandments, the way they are in the Maimonidean construction here in Mishnah Torah, in the Yad HaChazakah, in Hilchos Gezeila V'Aveda. If I may delve into something a little bit more complex for just 4 minutes. So, if anyone wants to take a break, perhaps even a sleep for 4 minutes till 6:40, be my guest. And then you'll be able to jump on the bandwagon again, no problem. Rabbi Avraham ben David of Poskier, the Ravid, who is known as for his criticism, sometimes sharp, of the Rambam's ruling, has two critical remarks, so to speak, two hasogos on the Rambam here. The Rambam poses the question, why is a person not liable to the statutory penalty of lashes, the 39 whips, flogging that one would normally get for the violation of a negative commandment? He says, because it does not entail any action. One does not receive lashes for this commandment because it doesn't entail an action. And the commentaries on the Rambam ask, what do you mean it doesn't entail an action? Of course it does. If you take someone else's Volvo, even if you pay for it, that is an action. If you end up marrying someone else's wife, that is an action. What else is it? And the commentaries all have a similar approach to this question. They say that according to the Rambam, the essence of the prohibition is the pressure that which one imposes upon the other person. Pressure, of course, is not a quantifiable action. It can sometimes be done without action. It can be done with body language. It can be done with words. It doesn't need to have a deed. What is the deed? The only deed is that eventually he purchases it. It is not the actual acquisition that constitutes transgression of the negative commandment. It is the pressure that one imposes that is the negative commandment. However, we have to give a shiur, a measure, to how much one has to pressurize before it becomes a violation of the negative commandment. The Rambam says that he is not over on this lav until which stage? Until he has actually acquired it. But the acquisition is really the last straw on the camel's back insofar as the Avera is concerned, but it isn't the Maaseh or Avera. I actually thought of a slightly different way of phrasing this, which I'd like to present here tonight, and maybe Rabbi Kahn will offer his comments on in his reciprocal remarks at the end, and that is as follows. That, and a good example for this is, because I was struggling to find an example of a commandment where you have a deed, but the deed, you need to do the deed in order to, the deed needs to be accomplished in order for transgression to take place. On the other hand, the deed is not an essential part of the transgression. And I thought of the example of Shabbos. Baking on Shabbos, for example. Let us imagine the following. You put a cake or a bread in a hot oven on Shabbos afternoon. So you've transgressed the prohibition of Shabbos. This is Melech HaSoifer. You might go to sleep afterwards. Once the cake is done or the bread is ready, you transgress Melech HaSoifer. What happens if before the cake is ready, someone else takes the cake out of the oven so it never gets baked? So then you haven't transgressed this commandment. Now here we have an interesting thing. The deed has been done. You put the cake in the oven. If no one else were to touch it, then it would become baked and you would transgress the commandment. But if the deed doesn't get done and someone else turns off the oven or removes the cake, then you have not transgressed this commandment. So, on the one hand, if we ask, why is this person, what is the maaseh avera? What constitutes the forbidden act? The answer is putting the cake into the oven. That is the maaseh avera. But the kiyum, the actual sin that the avera has to accomplish, can happen afterwards. It happens through a secondary stage when the cake gets baked, and if the cake doesn't get baked, then he hasn't done it. But the actual getting baked, which is the net result which is required, is not the deed that the Torah forbade. The deed that the Torah forbade is putting the cake in the oven in such a way that it can get baked. The fact that the cake actually becomes readily made is a titzor, is a result of this deed. And it's a result which is integral, without which you don't get any penalty for the prohibition that you have violated. In the same way here, the transgression of the Sachmoid in The Rambam's legal thought means you pressure. But it has to be the type of pressure that leads to a result. The result in this particular case is not the cake getting baked, but it is the person parting company with his possession and giving it to you. That is the moment when we say the cake is baked. But insofar as the commandment, the actual deed that you're doing, that is the violation that the Torah forbids, it is the pressure. Now the Rav disagrees. He says two things. When the Rambam says he pressurizes the other person until the other person parts company, says the Rav, that is provided that the other person does not say, I want to sell it. He doesn't say, I want to sell it. In other words, he doesn't agree to the sale. And the second thing the Rav says is, what do you mean? There's no deed involved. Of course there's a deed involved. You've taken someone else's object. The reason why no lashes are incurred, penalty of lashes are incurred, is because shuchai b'tashlumin, because you have to pay back the other person. It's not the end of the day. Alav shenitzem b'tashlumin, you've taken something that belongs to someone else, but you'll give it back. And the reason why there's no penalty of lashes is because there's only a penalty of lashes for a negative commandment if there is no way of rectifying this commandment. Where there is rectification by way of restoration, giving back the object, that's why there's no penalty of lashes. Commentaries explain that the Ravid understood the nature of leisachmoid is taking something without someone else's permission. You pay in full. The car is worth £1,000, you pay £3,000. But the other person never agrees. It's extortion. You're taking it from him without his acquiescence. Only then, according to the Ravid, is it leisachmoid. Of course, according to the Ravid's formulation, leisachmoid is actually a commandment that involves a deed. Because the taking is that which is forbidden, taking without someone else's permission. And therefore, he says that the leisachmoid applies only in a case where lo omar rotsani, the other person, did not say, I agree to sell it. By the same token, the writer tells us that the reason he does not get lashes, not receive the statutory penalty of lashes, malchus, or boim, is not because there's no ma'aseh, there is a ma'aseh from his perspective. It is because it is alav hanitin l'tashlumin, restoration can be achieved. At any rate, as I explained before, and now it is time for those who did take a short power nap for a few minutes. I gave you a little bit longer than I said I would, right? And of course there's a shail about going to sleep in a shul, and a beis haknesses, and a beis hamedrash, but I wasn't referring to that halacha. So those who come back now, according to the Rambam, and this is the way we paskin, at the end of the day, lo sachmai is achieved, through either the plan to employ pressure, to apply pressure, or the actual application of pressure. And I want to mention something else which is extremely important. And when I think of this, I think of Marcus Zichrona Levracha, and also Yibadi L'chaim Tovim of Wendy. There is a medrash that says, cited by Sefer Hasidim, amongst others. The word in the Torah, leisachmoid, could be spelt with a vav, and it could be spelt without a vav. That's the way words can be written in Hebrew. They can be written in full, clean, or deficient spelling. So, the word leisachmoid could be spelt sof ches mem vav dalet. It is actually spelt sof ches mem dalet. The Medrash says that the reason for this is because the words ought to be able to be read also as loisachmid, which is interpreted as the causative. Do not cause other people to desire that which is yours. Example. Perhaps some of the adult examples I gave may go too close to the bone for some people. So let's go back to the world of children. A young man comes to school, at the age of 9. He brings a whole bag of lollipops to school. And when it comes to the break time, he comes out into the playground and he takes out the whole bag. And he is quick to inform his colleagues in the playground that his mother has given him strict instructions that he mustn't give anyone any lollipops, they're all his. The entire packet. The entire lollipop is all his. So what happens is, as soon as all the kids start swarming around him, and they stand there like, panting, perhaps, ulai yirachim, maybe this kid will give, share some of his goodies, and he'll give them a lollipop as well. But, the kibbud aim, I believe it's his Mother's Day, the kibbud aim of this child achieves great heights. Under no circumstances will he give any lollipops to anyone else. Now, what's happened here is two things. On the one hand, the children have violated the commandment of Lo Yisachmit. Well, they certainly violated the commandment of Lo Yisaveh because they tried to get the other person's lollipop. They stood there the whole break. Please, I'll be your best friend, etc. So they certainly violated Lo Yisaveh. And if the boy's resistance broke, finally his intransigence yielded to the pressure and he gave away the lollipop, then they've done Lo Yisachmit as well. Okay, they're children, they need to be taught. That's why they have to go to school. Fine. That's Lo Yisachmit. But something else has taken place as well here. The child who brought the lollipops to school, or the mother who gave the child the lollipops to take to school, has violated Lo Yisachmit. What's Lo Yisachmit? Do not cause others to desire that which is yours. Do not indulge, and now we come back to adults, in ostentatious behavior, in such a way, in exhibitionism, in flaunting one's blessings, one's beauty, one's wealth, one's whatever it may be, in such a way that is unquestionably going to provoke the other person's desire. This is a very strange law. Modern secular law knows nothing like it. It doesn't even know anything of Lo Yisachmit. Certainly not of Lo Yisachmit. And I say this because if there's one point which I could emphasize in the entire spectrum of this shiur, that I could hear Marcus say would be this Lo Yisachmit. Yes, I have blessings, but I don't need to wear them all up my sleeve and show them off and flaunt them and cause other people's mouths to water in desperation for that which I have. Humility and enjoying God's blessings with that humility, discretion and privacy was something that characterized him and also characterizes his wife Wendy, whom we all know and appreciate so dearly. But this is all the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. Of course you can't ask the question anymore, how can you command a person not to feel? You can feel whatever you want. You can crave for Heimdall's Morgan, a person is allowed to have this feeling, but he mustn't do anything about it. He mustn't even think about doing anything about it. However, the Ibn Ezra, the Rashbam, and many other, the Chizkuni, many other commentaries on the Torah clearly did not understand Lo Yisachmit this way. They understood it in the more conventional way and in accordance with the more conventional translation. Lo Yisachmit means do not covet. In other words, do not crave for that which belongs to someone else. And by the way, even according to this interpretation, they didn't mean to say, do not covet, that means you're not allowed to want something similar. A person is allowed to want a similar Volvo. You can say, I saw your Volvo, I really fell in love with it, I'm going to get one the same as myself. That's okay. But if he wants that which belongs to the other person, not a house which is as grandiose as the other person's house, he wants that house. He's not happy just in accordance with the new minhag to knock his own house down and rebuild it again in a way that resembles the other person's house. He wants actually to drive the other person out of his house so that he can take over possession. This is the, even the desire to do this is a violation of Leisach Moed. And here, according to this formulation, we must come back and address the original question. How can a person drive such a desire out of his house, out of his mind, out of his heart? There are various interpretations. There is the Eben Ezra, there is the Beis Halevi, there's others. What I would like to suggest is a beautiful thought that I once saw in a sefer called Eretz Hatzvi. Eretz Hatzvi, the sefer written by Rabbi Aryeh Tzvi from Hashem Yikim Domoy, perished in the Holocaust. He was a Talmud of the Shem Yishmol, who was in turn a Talmud of the Avi Meza, the Sachachava dynasty. He was known as the Kozhuglov Rov, the Rov of the Polish town city of Kozhuglov. The sefer Eretz Hatzvi, he wrote Shas HaTshuvos, he wrote Responsa, but he also wrote a sefer on the Torah and a sefer on the Moed. And in the sefer on the festival, he gives a beautiful insight into Leisach Moed, which I think that Marcus will appreciate and his family will likewise appreciate. Before going to the main thrust of what he says that we're not talking about jealousy. Jealousy is, of course, another category. Jealousy means a person sees someone else, he gets jealous. It's not necessarily he wants the same thing. He's just jealous of the other person. Jealousy is not forbidden. It's a negative character trait. The Mishnah says a person who is jealous will drive himself out of the world or make himself ill. We're talking about desiring that which belongs to someone else. How does a person change his emotional chemistry that he shouldn't desire that which the other person has? Again, remember the situation. This is the car and there's no other car like it. This is the woman or the man and there's no other woman or man like it. Like him or her. So you'll tell him there's another man or there's another woman, he's not interested. He's got dafka, his mind and heart are set and focused 24/7 on this particular object of his desire. So how does he change? So he suggests the following two calculations. Meditation. Meditation number one is based on a meditation of Rav Nosson, which I'm going to paraphrase. There are two people sitting at Shal HaShudas. And there's a plate of Schmaltz herring on the table. One person eats the Schmaltz herring with a schnapps, a whiskey, single malt, and it's mamish me'ein olam haba. This is the best thing. Oynech Shabbos personified. Real delight. The other person is eating the same herring, the same whiskey, and it tastes like straw. He's got a fever, he's got a temperature, his taste buds are not working. So he has the same thing. And it actually tastes like nothing. So what the problem is, the same happens, the same risk. The answer to this question is that happiness, clearly, or delight in this case, lies not in the whiskey, nor in the herring, but in the palate. And therefore, when the person sees the other person enjoying his herring so much, so, there's no point in him being jealous for the herring, or wanting the other person's herring, he's eating the same piece of herring. There's no difference. So where is the difference? The difference is in himself. If his taste buds start working, then he can enjoy his piece of herring just as much as someone else's. He doesn't need the other person. And if his taste buds remain remain impotent, then however much herring, even if you take the herring out of the other person's mouth and put it in his, it'll still not taste the same. Happiness is not in the object, it is in the experience of the one who has it. That's the first principle. And this is something which even an atheist can understand. You don't need to be a man. The second stage, however, is a reflection which a believer understands. A believer can say to himself, look, if God would like me to enjoy my herring, then he can restore the health to my taste buds and my palate will really become tickled with this schmaltz herring. So I don't need the other person's herring. If, on the other hand, it is predestined, it has been decreed from upon high, that then I'm not going to enjoy this herring, it doesn't make any difference which herring I have. It's not going to make a difference. So this reinforces the point that not only can happiness depends on the person who's experiencing the object rather than the object itself, but that actually that can change. When a person takes these considerations, these two contemplations and meditations into consideration, he then works out like this. The reason that I am so fixated on someone else's car, or someone else's house, or someone else's wife, or someone else's husband, is why? Because I have associated, in my mind, happiness with that which belongs to the other person. The two have become linked. The two have become intrinsically linked. In my mind, they're inseparable. The Volvo, that's happiness. If I can get that Volvo, then I will have made it. I will feel tranquil. Any other Volvo will not make me feel tranquil. But the reality is not that way. A little bit of therapy will help the person realize that actually it's not the item, it's the experience. And the experience is not restricted to that particular item. Therefore, in accordance with the Rebbe, the Kosh Glavirov, he says, and actually what it means is this, the Sachmoid, according to the Eben Ezra, must be fulfilled through a process of what we may describe as a self-therapeutic process. A process whereby, yes, you can't just come to a person whose heart skips a beat when he sees someone else's car and say, you know, get a pacemaker and don't skip a beat. Just remain indifferent. It's not going to work. You can't do that. That's like commanding a person to jump from the ground onto the roof. What you can, however, do is you can train the person to go through a thought process, a process of an intellectual, an emotional analysis of his own desire, that will lead him to being able to separate between the object and his desire. Because ultimately his desire is for pleasure, for gratification, for personal fulfillment. That's what he wants. He thinks that this will be found in the body of a particular house, object or person. But that is not true. He may, as we see so often, get hold of that object and still not be happy. Or, as we also see, he may get hold of a different object and be doubly happy. So therefore it is the calculation that is wrong. And the commandment of Reisachmai therefore becomes an extremely psychotherapeutic commandment, which involves using a person's intellect and emotions in a mature and sophisticated way, so that the person can actually reach the stage where he fulfills the Leisachmoid and his desire for that which the other person has dissipates and his craving becomes focused on a desire for happiness which is only natural, healthy and normal and of course obtainable if God's blessing dictates it in this way. It is with this that I conclude the major section of my lecture. When I chose the subject, I'm going to, I hope I won't cause any embarrassment here, God forbid. Wendy said to me, why did you choose this subject? And what relevance do these character traits have with Marcus and things that we spoke about together, myself, Marcus, and Wendy, many times over many years? I hope now that question has been answered, the values that you stand for and of your Marcus Blessed Memory stood for and continues to stand for, have been extrapolated upon in an adequate and beneficial manner. What remains to be said, just very briefly, is that, as we know, Marcus, I spoke to him in his last days as well, but throughout his life was very fond, he was a family man. Rabbi Kahn spoke about his community endeavors, which of course doesn't need to be underscored. But I just want to mention and emphasize once again his deep love for his wife, for his parents, for his sister, her family, and last but by no means least, his children, his love for Hannah, his love for Adam. These were very great and intense feelings that he had. And it was ultimately for them, for these people, that he lived for. And therefore I hope and pray that you, his dear family, children, and all those that benefited from his example, those here in Shul and further afield, will take the message from his life, the message of character refinement, which ultimately are the two words that encapsulate everything I've said tonight. Something which was for him was an essential component of Yiddishkeit, and continue in the path that he trod, leading to a world which is segotten to light, good for God and good for mankind. Tov l'shamayim, v'tov l'briyos, good for heaven and good for the creatures. Tehei nafsho yitzruo b'tzor ha'chaim, may the neshama of Moshe ben David be bound in the eternal bond of life. Amen.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Rappaport, for that, shall I say, enviable shiur. I'd like to also thank everybody for their giving of their time and showing their solidarity to Marcus and to the family, making the effort to be here this evening. And I'd like to comment just a little bit on the topic of the shiur, and I think this is something that goes way beyond the whole civil concept of law, of the sense of law and order, the sense of right and wrong, that the Jewish values give us. As we know, the law keeping by the law of the country, the laws are that you mustn't do this, you must do the other, and it's a list of do's and don'ts. What the Torah demands from us, which is ultimately for our good, and I would say only for our good, is that the Torah governs the way we think. And that it's not just good enough, and that's what we've heard during the shiur, it's not just good enough the way we behave, but an education is given to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, by God, as to how we should think. Because the way we think is ultimately the way we're going to behave. And I think today's example of society is a perfect proof of that. Education has to be, we have to educate ourselves, our children, and those around us to think positively, to think in a way which is correct, honest, and above board. If we can manage to do that, if we can get behind the actions of a person, and we can train ourselves and others to think in an honourable fashion, not just, as some people call it, the 11th commandment, which is not to get caught, but that we want to behave in an honourable fashion. That is the way we think. That is our very essence. Our actions will indeed live up to that expectation. If, however, it's merely a facade, don't do this, and if you get caught, this is what will happen, we will never, as we can see in society today, we will never achieve the desired goal. And this is what the gem that the Torah has for us, and an example that we can show the world. I'd like to make an appeal on behalf of Mrs. Fielding. Mrs. Fielding has asked me to make this appeal, and she's written out for me the details of this work that's being continued in Marcus's name, and I'd like to lay this out for you and to give an idea of what is involved. The nature of this tzedakah, of this charity, is the following. It's a Witzo center in Afula, which is, to those who know it, a very deprived area, socially very deprived area in Eretz Yisrael, in Israel. There's a tremendous amount of poverty, and it provides meals, one hot meal a day, for people who would otherwise not even have that bare minimum. It also deals with situations of domestic violence and abuse to try and give support to those people who have been exposed to that, at the same time giving therapy to victims of terrorism. So here this is welfare really at its core. And this is something that Marcus started and set into operation, and thanks to your generous contribution so far, the centre has been set up, the assembly hall on the first floor, and the audio-visual facilities on the second floor are going to be dedicated to Marcus's memory. The funds that are required are £15,000 to be able to complete this work. And this is somehow, if we can manage to contribute towards this in a major part, that we can get towards this figure. This is the extent of the appeal. This facility will help children from 12 and up, from the poorest families who would otherwise not have the ability to be able to learn a trade, to be able to earn an honest living in future years. It will give them a way of learning a trade, to be able to stand on their own 2 feet in the financial sense, and hopefully this will contribute greatly to their ability to do so in the social sense as well, to keep them afloat and to make them into respectable and stable members of society. This was something that Marcus started. He produced a film to be able to fundraise particularly for this, and Chana is continuing in this field to be able to, in the film, make it specifically to be able to help and be able to solicit funds to help others. This is certainly a worthy cause. We need to look after Acheinu B'nai Yisrael, we need to look after Jewish people, we need to look after all people, but first and foremost to look after those who are so impoverished in Eretz Yisrael. And those who are not aware of the extent of this project, would like to know some more are welcome to ask Mrs. Fielding. She'll be able to give you more details. And charity vouchers should be made to Witso, is that right? Should be made out to Witso and can be given to Mrs. Fielding. And your generosity, continued generosity, will be very much appreciated to be able to continue help Mrs. Fielding continue Marcus's work. It's a big mitzvah for all of us to give to a cause like this. And I thank you on Mrs. Fielding's behalf in advance for your generosity. I'd also like to mention that, again, thank you all for coming, and to invite you all to a little kiddush or a little l'chaim upstairs. I don't know how much herring there's going to be. I don't know how much whiskey there's going to be, but I hope there'll be, whatever there is, there'll be plenty to go around. There'll be no necessity to take anything out of anyone's mouth. And in Mitzvah Hashem, please come upstairs. The purpose of this is to make a brocha before you eat something. We make a brocha, and the brocha, that brocha that we thank Hashem for what we're going to enjoy and have a little taste of, a little bit to eat, a little bit to drink, that blessing to HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be in Marcus's memory and in certainly solicited by him, because the family have laid this on for us. Thank you very much for coming, and we hope that we'll be able to keep this connection with you all and gather together only for happy occasions, for positive occasions, which this is a positive occasion of inspiration. Thank you for coming. Thank you.